conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If you need assistance during your call, please press star then zero, and I will assist you. Ms. Burton, you may begin.
Thank you. So just one reminder, we remind everybody at the start of each charm, if you have any noise on your line, star 6 will mute your phone if you don't have... So welcome to the, what is this, January Charm Telecon. We're lucky to be joined by five scientists that work with Cassini, and they're all interested in observing the aurora. And I think what I'll try and do is make a brief introduction, a couple lines about their background and what they're interested in at the beginning. A couple of our scientists are joining us from the UK, and so they might ring off after their presentation. So if you have questions for the individual speaker, please address them to that speaker while they're still on the line. The speakers are certainly welcome to stay till the bitter end. So we're going to start off with Claudia Alexander. She's from here at JPL, and she's Cassini's staff scientist. Oh, I should introduce everybody properly. It's Dr. Claudia Alexander. And in addition to her work as Cassini staff scientist, she's also a commentary scientist and Rosetta project scientist. So Claudia is going to give us some introductory remarks. She was instrumental in spearheading a sort of beefed-up auroral observing campaign for the XXM. So she'll stay on the line and help me MC the rest of the presentations. And then we'll be followed by Dean Talboys, and he's at the University of Leicester, and our scientists at Leicester are very active in studying the aurora, and we have two of them today. Dean sent me a few lines of bio. I was interested to read that he was a scientist on the British Beagle 2 expedition, the ill-fated expedition to Mars. That was interesting. And he's been working on in situ measurements. So these are science measurements that are taken in place as opposed to the remote sensing observations of the aurora. And then we'll be followed by Tom Stallard, also from the University of Leicester. And he really spearheaded the use of the VIMS data, one of the instruments on Cassini, in terms of looking at the aurora. And he's also been active in ground-based observations of the aurora and probably much more. But he can tell us about that. And Uliana Dudina is at Caltech. She's a staff scientist there, and she's been working on with the imaging team, ISS team, and she's got some extremely cool images of the aurora, the auroral curtain that we'll get to see. And she's also got, I don't know if we'll get to hear about her recent lightning observation, but she's got that too. And then at the end, it'll be Wayne Pryor, professor of astronomy and geology from Central Arizona University, and he's a UVIS co-I. And he's going to talk about remote sensing of the aurora. So that's what we've got planned for today. And if I didn't say it in the beginning, I think the best way to view the presentations, they're not merged into one PowerPoint, is to create a folder and download the PowerPoints. And there's a lot of animations, a lot of movies. Put them in one folder, and I did that, and everything played just fine for me. So I think with that said, we're going to go to Claudia Alexander.
Go, Claudia. Okay. I actually am not finding the place to download the documents. I went to the CHARM page, and it says they're not yet available.
Oh, okay. So you may have gone to where the PDFs are located. And we do not have that available yet. It will be available shortly after the telecon. And where you need to go is the PowerPoint, where the PowerPoints are located. And that's in the email. And I can give you the URL. And it's http://saturn.jpl.nasa.gov/doclib, all lowercase, /charm. All uppercase, and then you will need to log on with the password, which is coming up. Something really simple. Okay, it's Cassini, username Cassini, password is capital D, lowercase OC, $85.
Okay. I'm gonna talk while I'm doing that. And
okay.
The reason why I asked was because my introductory remarks are somewhat visual, and if people were sort of stuck without having the package, I'm going to try to describe as much as I can.
Yeah, I don't.
I just want to take care a little bit to make sure that I do a little bit of extra description just in case.
Yeah, okay. The package is there, Claudia, so I would just go ahead with the premise that people have it.
Okay, that people have it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, what I wanted to do is introduce the Aurora. We all kind of, I don't know how many people out there have actually seen Aurora, but, you know, if you go up and you're in Alaska or you're in any place where there's auroral due to a solar flare or something, you look up and you see the beautiful sheets of color moving through the sky, sometimes very slowly and sometimes stretching across the sky. And then when you see aurora from other planets, a lot of times what you see is something that, looking down on the auroral oval, you see the bright, you know, halo of color. And while it's beautiful and exotic, I don't think people realize quite as much that the aurora is a fingerprint of what's happening in the magnetosphere, and it kind of mirrors down into the upper atmosphere of the planets. And so in the very first slide that I have here, Saturn's aurora, the ionospheric and magnetospheric fingerprint and a manifestation of interactions beyond. What we have is Saturn with the rings you see in the middle, and to the left would be where the sun is and where particles are coming from the sun. And to the right, with little blue squiggly lines moving around purple oval lines, would be part of what we call the magnetosphere. And what happens is that the dots in this diagram, which are charged particles from the sun, enter the magnetosphere, and in a complicated dynamics that I don't want to explain as part of this presentation, they end up getting trapped on those purple lines, which are called magnetic field lines, and they end up being driven into the atmosphere, where they deposit energy and they light up the components of the atmosphere, like cause it to fluoresce, and that's where we get the aurora. And so I'm going to go back to that, to this diagram repeatedly as I go through my introductory remarks, because I want people to be able to understand how we use the aurora to understand the dynamics of how the sun interacts with the planet and how a lot more about the planet's atmosphere and the planet's magnetosphere itself. So if we go to page 2, the next figure is an attempt to sort of illustrate what happens when that energy comes barreling down the magnetic field lines. So what we have is a sort of a pie-shaped wedge in which Saturn is shown with the upper atmosphere exposed, kind of like a man's bald head there, with little hair things sticking out, which are another representation of those magnetic field lines that we talked about before. And the little hexagon, pentagon-shaped things are upper atmospheric particles. And the squiggly lines moving down the magnetic field line are the charged particles coming from the magnetosphere being driven into the upper atmosphere with electromagnetic forces. And when they encounter those molecules in the upper atmosphere, they exchange energy with the molecules, and the molecules begin to fluoresce. So in the atmosphere, this is kind of what the bottom process that causes the aurora to commence is all about. On page 3, I go back to that drawing, and I show you that in different wavelengths, on this one we have a group of pictures of the aurora in the infrared, which is the VIMS instrument, and then we have some wave activity that is recorded by the plasma wave instrument, And we have aurora, we're looking at the aurora also in ultraviolet light. And so we can use multiple instruments to study the same phenomena and to look at how that phenomena is, you know, what we see. So so I drew a red line here. The spacecraft, let's say, might be sitting in the magnetosphere somewhere around where those blue squiggly lines that show the particles moving along the field lines and moving into the atmosphere as they go back and forth along that purple line. What you're looking at is actually a representation of motion of particles moving and bouncing along that magnetic field line, which is in purple, and the particle motion is in blue. So if the spacecraft is sitting there sensing this environment, you have the sort of tactile instruments and the ones that are kind of like your ears, nose, and mouth are able to, if you just close your eyes, you can imagine your ears, nose, and mouth sensing things, and you can sense the particles going by, and you can hear, sort of, because the wave motion in the environment can be translated into audio frequencies, and you can hear some of these noises and manifestations. And then if you open your eyes and you're one of these instruments that looks in the infrared or the visible or the ultraviolet and look down on the auroral oval, you can see the brightenings and the motion of things that are happening in the oval. And what we're trying to do here with Cassini is try to understand how what's happening with the in situ instruments, the ones that are hearing and tasting and smelling what's going on in the environment, how that correlates with what we see in the auroral oval itself, because we know that the physics is connected. On page 4, I'm showing the ultraviolet, some of the features in the ultraviolet, and what I want to point out, because Wayne is going to really talk about these features a lot more, I'm quite sure, but you see some highly structured brightenings and some brightenings that are, you know, not just in a round oval, but have wave motions on them and have arcs and disconnected features on them. And what we hope to do is to find out if those wave motions are actually correlated with the motion of the magnetic field lines. It's the magnetic field lines that are waving in the magnetosphere, and as the particles get deposited in the atmosphere and cause it to fluoresce, you're seeing a mirror image, perhaps, of how the magnetic field, what waves are going on in a macroscopic way in the magnetosphere itself. So this is, you know, quite a fascinating, for us, attempt to understand by looking at the aurora the physics of what is transpiring in the larger venue of the magnetosphere. On page 5, what we have is the first visible aurora, visible wavelengths, was seen in October of last year, and we were quite excited by these images and movies that were taken. And in the picture, the black is basically, there's the Saturn limb, which has that bright feature on the leftmost, middle left edge. There's a sort of a bright feature, and you see the limb is drawn in, and also some latitude lines are drawn in there. And at mid-latitudes, you see this curtain of auroral visible light enhancements that have been captured. And what is noticed that is that the flickers and changes happen on timescales of minutes. The curtains rise 1,200 kilometers above Saturn, or about 750 miles. That's pretty deep. You've got a whole depth of fluorescence and energetic particles, energetic deposition happening along those curtains. And the patterns seem to rotate with Saturn. So, again, this is more structures that will help us to understand how the energy that's hitting the atmosphere, what's causing it to glow, and how those auroras are generated. In the next page 6, it's more than just the plasma wave and the remote sensing instruments, the visible, the infrared, and the ultraviolet. What we also have, the whole instrument suite is being used to understand the connection and the coupling between the upper atmosphere of the planet and the magnetosphere. So we have the MIMI, which has the ability to image energetic neutral atoms, which is what ENA means. What we have here are images that are reconstructed from the MIMI instrument's ENA signatures. And in part A, the upper diagram, you see Saturn in the very middle, and you see some auroral brightenings that take place in the ultraviolet. And this would be quiescent, but you do see that there are some blobs of brightening happening, and it's not clear how those are tied to the magnetic field. But in the lower panel, we have this incredible energy enhancement that is seen in the energetic neutral atom signature, with the red being the most intense and then going back down to the blue. And if you look at Saturn in the middle there, you see kind of right underneath an intense brightening in the aurora, as if the particles are being dumped into the upper atmosphere of the planet as this blob approaches from the night side. So this is the kind of thing, again, if we look at my sort of standard diagram there, and if you imagine a pressure pulse coming from the sun from the left, and the particles moving around over the top of Saturn and coming in the backside and getting stuck onto those purple lines and start becoming some of the blue lines, something causes them to be forced into the auroral oval. And so by sitting on those purple lines and watching a blob come by, and then watching the auroral oval light up, this is how we try to understand what's the physics of how the sun interacts with the planet, the particles get in, and then the particles get smushed into the upper atmosphere of the planet. Let me go back to slide number slide number four for a minute, and that diagram is in the lower left-hand corner, and I have a little arrow, because not only do we have the particles in blue going back and forth, bouncing along the field lines, but that whole field line structure rotates with Saturn, and I have an arrow showing it rotating into the page. And so when we look at the auroral oval and we look at those wiggly structures in the auroral oval, what I was trying to show there was that that's a rotating structure that's in 3D, and we're trying to understand not only the brightenings that happen when stuff gets dumped going down into the auroral oval, but as it moves around in the circle and as the magnetosphere moves, what are the wave components that also get translated into the auroral oval. So with that, I'm going to go to my last slide, which is slide 7, and again showing the beautiful, you know, representation of all the physics that we're trying to understand here, and say that after 5.5 years of the Cassini mission, we have collected many outstanding observations of the aurora, including understanding the current systems that are driving particles into the atmosphere and the plasma and radio signatures. As the northern auroras come into view by on Earth, you know, you think of the Hubble Space Telescope as Earth ground-based, even though that sounds a little silly because it's in space, compared to our flying spacecraft that are actually at the planet, Hubble spacecraft is ground-based. And as the northern aurora comes into view by Hubble, we have the potential to do joint ground and Cassini observations of this interesting and unique phenomena. So with that, obviously if there's any questions that people want to ask right now, I'm happy to take that. Otherwise, I will turn it back over to Marcia.
That's great, Claudia. Thank you very much. So basically, I mean, the idea is Cassini's trying to implement a more focused program to coordinate these observations so that by the time the mission's over, hopefully in 2017, we'll really have done a good job in understanding the aurora. So that's what we're having various workshops, scientific workshops and things to try and implement. Right, Claudia?
Okay.
So the next speaker is going to be Dean Talboys. So the presentation, if you're looking, if you're listening live and not listening to the audio recording, if you launch the presentation Talboys, so it has charm and a date in front of it, but it's Talboys, that's the one to take a look at. And with that, I'll introduce again Dean Talboys from the University of Leicester, and he's one of the scientists who are interested in the in situ observations. So, Dean?
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be invited along to give this presentation. And thank you to Claudia as well for some excellent background that's really going to help with this presentation. So, I'm going to be talking about Saturn's high latitude field line currents and how they're linked to the aurora. So, Claudia showed how the electrons spiral down the field lines in the polar regions and impact in the ionosphere, produce the radiation at all sorts of wavelengths that we observe as the aurora. And I'll be talking about the field line currents, essentially these electrons, that the currents that are aligned with the field, literally. So if we go to the second slide, the basic question is, what is the origin of Saturn's auroral emission? Now, you can see here that the aurora has been observed at all sorts of different wavelengths, in the infrared with the FIMS instrument, in the ultraviolet with the UVIS instrument, both on Cassini, but also with the legendary Hubble Space Telescope with remote imaging. You can see the panel there. So essentially, what we're looking at, we've been able to explore these high latitude field line currents because Cassini has had a series of phases of high latitude orbits, which has allowed it to cross these field lines that connect to the aurora, these field lines along which the electrons spiral down into the ionosphere. So it's thanks to Cassini's polar expeditions, as it were, that we've been able to observe these currents. Now, if we go back to the look at the Earth and in understanding the aurora there, then if we move on to slide 3, we see the first person to really predict or hypothesize the currents that produced the aurora was Christian Birkeland, who went on several polar expeditions himself to try and understand the auroras at Earth. Now, Birkeland actually predicted in 1896 that the auroras were produced by these particles from space, from the sun, impacting into the ionosphere. And it wasn't actually till 65 years later when U.S. Navy satellites made measurements and directly detected the currents that his predictions were confirmed. And, of course, they were christened Birkeland currents. So in the top left, we have a Norwegian banknote. Birkeland was Norwegian, and it's a 200 kroner banknote. I don't know how much that actually is in dollars or pounds, but it has a few nice details there relating to his aurora research. On the left of Birkeland's portrait, you can see a sort of aurora arc coming out of his shoulder, and you see a snow crystal there. With a pole star nearby, which is meant to represent the Arctic, because as I mentioned earlier, he went on several Arctic expeditions to try and understand the auroras at Earth anyway. The Arctic expeditions were between 1897 and 1903, so quite an extensive period of exploration. And to the left there, you'll see a drawing. There's a very small picture of what was called Birkeland's Torella chamber. Now, if you go to the right, we're looking in Birkeland's lab here, Birkeland's on the left and his assistants on the right, and in the center you can see the Torella, which is otherwise known as a little Earth. It's essentially a metallic ball painted with a phosphorant paint in a vacuum chamber. And this ball had an electromagnet inside. And he basically built this experiment to understand how the auroras were produced at Earth. So he essentially had a cathode ray tube that spat out electrons, which was meant to simulate the particles from the sun. And Birkeland would power the experiment, first the cathode, and then the electromagnet in the ball, and then in a few seconds you would have seen two rings of light at the poles. So if you look at the lower right-hand corner, you can see the particles streaming down into the poles there, and the two rings of light. So if you were looking at this in the first years of the 20th century, it would have been pretty amazing, I think, if have a glimpse of what the Earth's auroras might look at like from space. And in the bottom right-hand corner, we have a diagram from one of Birkeland's famous papers, just showing how these field line currents carry the electrons into the Earth's ionosphere and produce the aurora. So, yes, I wanted to introduce Christian Birkeland because it stretches back to he made the first predictions of the currents of the Earth. And as I said, these weren't confirmed until the U.S. Navy satellites made the predictions. And now, for the first time at Saturn, we're making these observations of the currents thanks to Cassini's polar expeditions. Right, so moving on to slide four then. What I'm showing is a schematic of the essentially the magnetosphere, ionosphere coupling current system at Saturn. So essentially the dashed lines are the current system and the solid lines are the magnetic field lines, exactly how in the same arrangement that Claudia showed in her presentation. So the question arises, how do we actually detect these current systems? So essentially Cassini traverses the high latitude field lines. So you imagine an arc going at high latitudes, and it cuts through these current systems. Now this whole current system sets up a sort of perturbation field in the magnetic field, which is directed azimuthally. So you can see in the northern hemisphere, B-phi is directed out of the page towards us, and in the southern hemisphere, B-phi is directed into the page. So as the planet spins around, we get the red stuff in the equatorial plane is the plasma. That subcorrotates, lags behind the rotation of the planet, which sets up this current system you see here, and the current system sets up these field perturbations that you can see there. Now, if the plasma were rotating faster than a planet, or superco-rotating as we call it, if there was some dynamical event in Saturn's magnetosphere, then the directions of the currents would be reversed, and so would the directions of the perturbation field. So the take-home message here really is that we've been using the azimuthal field as a diagnostic of the currents that are flowing into or out of the ionosphere. So just one final point is that when I talk about upward currents, that represents downgoing electrons into the ionosphere which produce the aurora. So it's the upward currents that we're looking out for in the Cassini in situ data. So moving to slide five then, this slide, I think it's really nice because this shows the campaign that occurred in 2007 showing simultaneous images of the aurora using HST, the Hubble Space Telescope, and at the same time Cassini was exploring the high latitude magnetosphere and making in situ measurements. And what we're seeing here on the left and the right are polar projections of the aurora, just like as if you were looking essentially onto the southern hemisphere of the planet, actually viewed from inside the planet, in fact. So noon is at the bottom, so the sun points towards the bottom, dawn on the left and dusk on the right. And the white track that you see there is actually the spacecraft trajectory. mapped to the ionosphere. So the field, as a spacecraft moves through field lines, each of these field lines is connected to the ionosphere. So you can actually see the footprint, the fingerprint of the spacecraft in the ionosphere. Now, the red dot shows the position of Cassini at the time each image was taken. And you can see between the time the images were taken, Cassini's crossed over the Aurora Oval. That means it's crossed through field lines connected to the oval and therefore through the currents that are also connected to the oval. So if we go to slide 6, what we're going to do here is look at the in-situ observations. Roll our sleeves up and get hands dirty a little bit with this with the data. But first, I'll turn your attention to the orbit on the right-hand side. So in the top panel, we've got the equatorial XY plane. We're looking down onto the equatorial plane, basically, with the sun on the right. And in the bottom panel, we've got the noon midnight XZ plane, which is essentially the equatorial plane, but viewed from the side. So focusing on that bottom panel, we can see that the two red dots there show that the time the images were taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. We can see that Cassini was at very high latitudes in the southern hemisphere. And if we look at the top panel, we can see that was quite near to noon. So if we go over to the in-situ observations, we've got the top panel, which is essentially a measurement of the energy and intensity, number density of the electrons, measured by the Cassini electron spectrometer. So this is an electron spectrogram at the top. And the next three panels show the magnetic field in spherical polar coordinates. So the magnetic field is a three-dimensional thing encompassing the magnetosphere and beyond. And at the bottom, we have the magnitude of the field. But really, just what I want you to concentrate on is the azimuthal field, B phi, in the fourth panel there. And you can see that between the time the images were taken, you see the field shifting, essentially moving from positive to small values and back again. So it's these perturbations in the azimuthal field that's really indicative of currents. And we can see upward currents in there, meaning we're sampling the currents that produce the aurora. Now, if we look at the top panel, we can see roughly where image A was taken. There's a distinct lack of electrons, and then we move on to an interval where you can see electrons at between 100 and 10,000 EV, as you can see on the scale there. So the period where you get the clear blue sky, as it were, means we're on open field. So if you remember Claudia's image that she showed there, near the poles, the magnetic field lines just went off into space. They weren't connected back to the planet, which means that the electrons just spiral off along the field lines into space. So we've got no field lines there. And on the other side, where you see the electron plasma, this is a closed field region. So this is a region where the plasma is confined by the magnetic field. So essentially, what we're seeing is we're combining the remote observations with this in-situ information. It's telling us that there's an upward field line current at the boundary between open and closed field lines that coincides with the auroral oval. So if we go to slide 7, I don't have a lot to say about this slide other than that at the top panel we've got the azimuthal field again. The second panel we've actually calculated the current that's and therefore the current density that's inferred from this. And at the bottom panel we have the co-latitude of Cassini, which is essentially the same as the spacecraft track on the right-hand side. But really the message to take home from this is that the current densities were sufficient to produce the observed brightness of the aurora, so of 20 to 30 kilorayleighs. So really we established a direct link between these currents and the aurora. So moving rapidly on to slide 8. Now, this orbit in January 2007, that wasn't the only high-latitude orbit. There were a number of other high latitude orbits that bracketed it. And here's one, again, in the I'm showing the orbit here. In the top left-hand corner, we're looking down onto the equatorial plane. On the top right-hand corner, again, looking at the equatorial plane from the side. And we can see, essentially, that Cassini passed from very high southern latitudes, the high northern latitudes, and it crossed the equator in between. It crossed the equator when it was near to noon, sort of along the Saturn-Sun line. So that's all I wanted to say about that slide. So if we move to slide 9, here's a broader sort of overview of the in-situ data from that what's called the periapsis pass. So it comes inbound, passes very close to Saturn, and then goes outbound. So what we have here, if we look at the electron data at the top, we have clear blue sky on either side of an intense plasma signature. That intense plasma signature is the signature of the ring current, this donut-shaped plasma region that's confined to the equatorial regions. And if we look at the azimuthal field, it's the fourth panel down again, we can see that there's like sort of oscillatory signals at about the rotation period of Saturn. And these are the magnetospheric oscillations that have been observed that are ubiquitous in all aspects of the magnetosphere. But you can also see just when Cassini crosses into the ring current region on the inbound and the outbound, you can see perturbations in the azimuthal field. So let's take a closer look at those on slide 10. This is the inbound view in the southern hemisphere. And the top panel, we have the electron spectrogram, then we have the current once again, and then we have the ionospheric co-latitude of Cassini, so the position of Cassini mapped to the ionosphere. And the horizontal blue lines, that's actually the statistical oval. So this is essentially a statistical average location of the aurora observed in the UV that was obtained from Hubble Space Telescope data. So essentially the message I'd like to give you here is the arrows in the current panel in the middle indicate the direction of the current. So we have three upward currents followed by a downward current. And you can see essentially the three upward currents, region 0, 1A and 1B as we labeled it there, coincide quite nicely with the location of the aurora. And this is followed by a downward current that coincides with the outer ring current. If we go to slide 11, we can see a slightly different morphology of the currents. So going from high to low latitudes, that's right to left in the plot, you can see that we get essentially a downward, upward, downward directed currents there. So essentially the message is this period of orbits, the currents between the two hemispheres were somewhat different. And slide 12 really gives us a view of the locations of the currents with respect to the statistical location of the aurora. So what we have here, we're looking again at the southern ionosphere, and we've plotted in blue the statistical location of the aurora, and the red dashed lines are the locations of the ring currents. And the multicolored sort of track is the track of Cassini color-coded according to the directions of the current. So essentially, the purple, red, and orange regions of upward current, which correspond again to downward-going electrons, seem to correspond with the aurora quite nicely in these cases over multiple orbits. But if we look at the northern hemisphere, it's somewhat more variable. So in this case, the red segment is the upward current. Sometimes it's equatorward of the oval, sometimes it's poleward. But again, the aurora, this is only the statistical location. The auroras can be very variable, as we've seen in some of the amazing images from UVIS, VIMS, HST, etc. So moving on to slide 14, I'm this is really moving on to 2008. And for the whole of 2008, Cassini was in a whole bunch of high-latitude orbits. And here's one of the orbits. They're all pretty much the same. Here we see at the top left the New Midnight XZ plane. That's the equatorial plane viewed from the side. And you can see that Cassini passed from high northern to southern latitudes on its periapsis pass. And looking at the equatorial XY plane on the right-hand side, you can see that this happened quite near to midnight. So whereas before we were exploring the sort of the currents on the day side, now we're exploring the currents on the night side and the night side aurora. So in the bottom two panels on the left and the right, we have the spacecraft track, again, mapped to the ionosphere. And what I've done here is put a small oval, which indicates where we normally observe the night side aurora. So you can see that Cassini is rapidly passes through the aurora inbound and recrosses it outbound. So if we move on to slide 15, and the great thing about 2008 is there have been so much data that we can finally begin to build up a sort of statistical idea of where the currents lie and how it relates to the aurora, just like they did at Earth in the 70s with the U.S. Navy satellites. So really, if we were to draw a family portrait of the different types of currents, there's really two kinds. The first kind that we see here show essentially what sort of lagging field signatures. So the azimuthal field lags behind the meridional planes. And this is indicative of essentially sub-co-rotating plasma that's lagging behind the rotation of the planet. And so you can see essentially going from high to low latitudes, there's a downward current on open field lines and then an upward current starting at the open-closed field line boundary and extended into the ring current region. If we go to slide 16, here's the less common type of ring current, of field line current signatures. And essentially, it's a three-current structure. So we have from high to low latitudes a downward, upward, and downward current structure. And what's really interesting here is that the azimuthal field is positive in the northern hemisphere. Now, that means that it could be associated with plasma that's super co-rotating, that's actually moving in advance of the rotation of the planet. So there must be some dynamical event that's putting energy into the plasma, giving it sufficient angular momentum to rotate faster than the rotation rate of the planet. And essentially, we're still trying to figure out why. So it's an ongoing story we've got here. And then if we go to the final slide, slide 17, I've got a few open questions here that the joint Hubble-Cassini campaign really associated the high-latitude field line currents with the aurora for the first time. So it shows that the power of these campaigns, and as Marcia mentioned, there are plans to do more of these campaigns in the future. And certainly Cassini will be exploring the high-latitude magnetosphere again. Now, some of the open questions is how does the main aurora oval in the X-ray, the ultraviolet, the infrared, and the radio relate to these field line currents? And there's some sub-questions there talking about how the morphology of the azimuthal field, how they could be indicative of these dynamical events that may occur. And then a final question would be, if you look at the bottom left-hand side, you can see an image from UVIS, and you can see lots and lots of structure in those images that Wayne's going to talk about in more detail later. And a key question would be, how does the substructure of the field line currents, especially the upward field line current, relate to the fine structure of the aurora? So, it seems there's plenty to look forward to in the future in terms of in situ data, and with that, I'll leave it there.
That's great. Thank you, Dean. Are there any questions out there for Dean? So I've got a couple questions. I mean, one thing to point out certainly is for the in situ measurements, I mean, it's a complicated thing to make these measurements in the way that we plan to do it, because what we'd like to do ideally for the most comprehensive measurement is to image the aurora so that VIMS and UVIS and ISS can look at it, and at the same time have the instruments that measure in situ sort of have the right direction in their field of view, which is, you know, typically along the magnetic field line. So that's one thing that we hope to do in the extended mission, and it requires rather complicated pointing of the spacecraft. Second call for questions for Dean.
I have a couple comments.
Sure, Claudia.
I actually was, while he was talking, I was thinking, and Tom may say something about this, but as in these regions of the atmosphere where the current is coming down and there's so much energy deposition there, there's also a lot of chemistry. So the energy is driving, you know, chemistry in the upper atmosphere, which is, you know, we're all kind of interested in how those chemical changes happen and to understand the chemistry of the upper atmosphere and where some of these exotic molecules come from. And also because the energy drives waves and dynamism in the atmosphere itself. And so there's a coupling of energy and momentum between the magnetosphere and the atmosphere in this region. And so that's another, I think those are still some open questions about how the presence of these currents couples the magnetosphere and the atmosphere together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dean. And as I mentioned, you're welcome to stay online and listen to the rest of the speakers, but I know it's late in the UK. So thanks again. That was really interesting presentation. So we're going to move on to another speaker from the UK, Tom Stallard. Tom, you're there, aren't you?
Hello there.
Hey, Tom. And
hello.
Tom, as I mentioned, is also from the University of Leicester, and he's been working with the VIMS data and also with the ground-based observations. So let me see what his presentation is called. Probably something like Stallard. So if you download the PowerPoint, yes, okay, so it's got the date, and it says CHARM and then Stallard. So that's the presentation you want to be looking at right now. And with that, I'll give it to you, Tom.
Thank you. Maybe I should just address briefly the comment that Claudia made a moment ago. I'm not really going to talk in detail about the chemistry of the upper atmosphere, and certainly not the coupling between the ionosphere and the magnetosphere, which is something that we can actually work on, and we do work on using ground-based observations. I'm going to try and center in more in this talk about the ground-based observations we do in terms of the temperature structure and how those relate to the VIMS observations we've been making. But there's certainly an ongoing question, a particularly interesting question, is how the ionosphere and the magnetosphere interact and how this big weighty atmosphere directly drives some of the things that you see in the magnetosphere. So that's another, perhaps for another talk another day, but I'll come back round to what I was really going to be talking about, which is the Cassini-VIMS observation, in particular the observations not only of the infrared aurora but also of the upper atmosphere temperature structure. Now, unlike a lot of people who have been working with Cassini for many, many years, I only became involved about 2 years ago. My history is in the study of the infrared aurora of the gas giants, and I've been studying the infrared aurora of Saturn for more than a decade now, but I have in the past used ground-based observations to do those studies. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you about what infrared aurora are and why they're so important, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the work that I've done from the ground. Hopefully that will make you aware of why I feel what we're doing with Cassini now is so important, because it will hopefully throw in some light about the importance of these results and how impressive they really are in comparison to some of the work that we've done in the past. Okay, so I guess briefly before I move from the first slide, I should talk about all the names on this page. It's very important to me that I make clear that I'm not the only person involved in this. Not only is there an awful lot of involvement with the VIMS team on Cassini themselves, but there's this large cabal of people from the UK who work on either processing some of the VIMS data, or more specifically looking using the magnetometer data. So you can see Dean is on that list. People who work with the VIMS and MAG team in collaboration, and basically the observations that I do and that I've looked at in the past all come from this collaboration. So to me it's very important. I always give you a heads up about everyone involved in this. Okay, so we can move on to the second slide now. And this is just a slide showing you what we see from Earth when we look out into space in terms of what we can actually see. And I think it's quite a good way of starting this talk, because often people show UV images, and it's useful to try and get an understanding of why the infrared is different. So what you see here is a sort of a wide wavelength range in this profile. At the top, you can see marked out the different wavelength regions that we're looking at. And you can see, obviously, in the region where you have visible, the transmission percentage is very high. That means we get a lot of light coming through the atmosphere of the Earth. So that's why we evolved to be able to see the visible light, because there's so much of it coming through. But fortunately for us, there is a lot of ozone in the upper atmosphere. And what that means is that a lot of the UV, the harmful UV light, gets absorbed in the upper atmosphere, so we don't get skin cancer, which is great for humans, not so great for astronomers, because what that means is that we don't get to see any of that UV light down on the ground, so we can't observe the UV aurora from the ground, which is why there's been these wonderful images shown from Hubble and also, of course, in situ using Cassini. When you look at the longer wavelengths, at the infrared wavelengths that I'm interested in, you can see that that transmission spectrum starts to wiggle up and down quite a lot. And there's some regions where you can see a lot of light coming through, and some where you have things, species like water and carbon dioxide absorbing a lot of the light that's coming down from space, so we can't see anything at all. And underneath this, I've cut out a region that I'm particularly interested in, this sort of 2 to 4 or 5 micron region. And underneath there's this very thin, long spectra, and this is a spectra we actually took of the auroral region of Jupiter, which is a lot easier to observe, but you can sort of see some of the similar spectral features that you see for Saturn. So if we go to the next slide, what you should see now is the same picture, but with some green on it. And I've just marked the green to show where the Earth's atmosphere is absorbing all of that light. Now, of course, when we look with VIMS, that's not an issue at all. We see those regions perfectly clearly. But when we're looking at the spectra, it's good to know what we can't see. And there's no emission in that region just because the Earth is affecting everything. But in other regions, what we're seeing is actually what's coming from Jupiter in this case. So there's a lot of reflected sunlight coming from lower layers. But you can see a box that I've drawn and pulled out. Now, in that region, it's the Jovian atmosphere that is absorbing all the sunlight. An atmospheric window in Jupiter is being sealed off because of methane, and methane absorbs a lot of light in this wavelength range. So Jupiter and Saturn in that region are very dark, so we can't see the planet at all. But the aurora sits on top of that. So basically, you can see lots of individual lines, and those are individual lines of a particular molecule that we like to look at called H3+, which I'll describe in a little bit. And basically, that gives us a way of looking at the aurora in the infrared, basically against a dark planet. So that's a really good way of picking up the auroral emissions from the gas giants, and it gives you different features of what's going on compared with the UV, which I'll go into on the next slide. So if we go to slide 4, we should see a sort of fake planet atmosphere. Claudia did a very good job of explaining how the aurora form from particle precipitation coming in. What she was particularly talking about was the formation of UV aurora. So you can see that on the left, and that's the kind of aurora we call prompt emission aurora. The UV and visible aurora are both prompt emission, and basically all that means is you have an energetic particle going into the planet. It energizes the molecules, gives them energy, and then those energetic molecules then feel the need to release the energy back out, so you get a prompt emission. So effectively what you're seeing is the direct effect of the particle precipitation on the planet itself. Now, the situation for the infrared is somewhat more complex, and the details of this process aren't really that important, but basically what happens is you have an energetic particle coming into the atmosphere, and it ionizes the hydrogen in that atmosphere. So you end up with this molecule called H2+. Now, H2+ is very reactive, so the step between 1 down in the bottom and 2, where H2+ reacts with more hydrogen, is very, very quick. So very quickly you end up with quite a lot of H3+. H3+ doesn't react with hydrogen at all, so it just sort of sits there in the upper atmosphere. It gets bandied around a lot by the hydrogen up there, and it just sort of sits there for an extended period of time, several minutes, 10, 20 minutes maybe. And what that means is the step between 2 and 3 is representing the time that it's just sort of sitting there being pushed around before it finally is destroyed by other processes. And what that means is that the H3+ effectively takes on all of the characteristics of the neutral hydrogen. So if the hydrogen is at a temperature of 400 degrees Kelvin, the H3+ will also be at a temperature of 400 degrees. And it's the emission from the H3+ that is what we see. It's formed by this heating process. So you heat the H3+ up, and in order to cool itself down, it emits all of those different lines. So all those different lines we saw in the spectra on the last slide were H3+ cooling itself down, having been heated up by the neutral atmosphere. So what that means is what we're looking at when we're looking at the aurora is not only the processes involved in producing an aurora, as you would see in the UV, but there's also an additional element that is driven by the atmosphere itself. So if we go to the next slide, what we see is this little table of numbers. And if you ask any aeronomist, an aeronomist is someone who studies the upper atmosphere of the planet, any aeronomist that studies the gas giants, they will tell you that the most important question for us as aeronomists is, why are the gas giants' upper atmosphere so hot? If you look at the equatorial region, you can measure temperatures that are surprisingly high. You can see in the table there that Jupiter has a temperature of nearly 1,000 Kelvin, and even Saturn has at least 400. Underneath those values are temperatures that are calculated from the amount of heating they should get from the sun. And you can see that the temperatures that are calculated are below 200 degrees Kelvin. So these atmospheres are significantly heated compared to what you should expect them to be. So that's a big question for us, and it's been a big question for more than 20 years. And the way that people have tried to attack this question and understand this question is to model these atmospheres with very complicated model codes of the upper atmosphere dynamics and things like that. And we put in all sorts of different inputs, from heating from the auroral region, the winds that carry that heat around the planet, heating from below, and all of these different products. And the problem we're coming up with is that no matter what kind of information we're putting into these models, we're never able to get the temperatures at the equator up to the temperatures that we've actually seen with measurements. And that's a real problem in terms of trying to understand the upper atmospheres of these planets and understand the heat distribution and the energy distribution. So there's obviously something missing. And it's not the models that are wrong. The models are working perfectly fine. It's just the inputs that we're putting into those models that is wrong. So what we really need to do as observers is to improve the observations we're making, get better measurements so that the people modeling these upper atmospheres can get a much better understanding of the inputs that they need to put into their model. So that's kind of where my job comes in, both with ground-based observations and with observations from VIMS. So if we go to the next slide, we can see pictures from Hawaii. Now, when you're doing observations from the ground, you've got all sorts of additional considerations and problems that you have to deal with that you just don't have to deal with from space, which is another reason why I'm enjoying using VIMS so much. One of the problems that you get from the ground is, of course, that transmission spectra that I showed you at the start, where different absorption lines in the Earth's atmosphere knock out some of the light that you'd see from space. So one really good way of dealing with that is just to go up really high. So the higher you go up in the Earth's atmosphere, the less that has an effect on you. So the first thing you look for is somewhere that's nice and high. And another problem that you see is turbulence in the atmosphere. If you have a large body of land, that land gets hot, and you see a lot of turbulence in the atmosphere. And when you look through that turbulence from the ground, it basically smears out anything that you see. This is basically why stars twinkle. The twinkling of the stars is solely because the Earth's atmosphere is moving those stars around as we look at them. So that's very pretty, but a really bad thing for astronomy. So we want to go to somewhere where that turbulence is really, really minimized. So going into the middle of an ocean where there's no land masses around you is a perfect way of doing that. So Mauna Kea, the dormant volcano in Hawaii, is one of the best, if not the best, location in the world for doing this kind of observation. It's a really high mountain that has very little turbulent atmosphere around it. It's high enough that it's above most normal cloud, so you can get a lot of clear skies, and it's a really good place to observe. It's also a very nice place to visit, which is quite lucky for me. But it's by far the top one or two locations in the world to do these kinds of observations. And you can see at the top there's all sorts of telescopes up there because of that. There's actually 13 major telescopes at the summit, including telescopes like Keck, which is the largest ground-based telescope in the world with a 10-meter dish, and Subaru and Gemini also 8-meter dishes. But if we go to the next slide, I'm going to talk about a slightly smaller telescope. That's the NASA Infrared Telescope Facility, and this telescope is by far the best telescope to observe for if you're a planetary observer like me, because this was specifically set aside by NASA for ground-based support observations of planetary missions. So back in the Voyager days, this was set up solely to support space missions to the planets. So when we talk about doing observations at Cassini, and specifically about doing ground-based support for those observations, this is the go-to telescope. This is by far the best telescope. And the other thing to notice, even though this is a comparatively small telescope compared to some of the really big ones on the mountain, it's still a huge telescope. It's a very big telescope. And if you look at the instrumentation underneath the telescope, it's much, much larger than anything you could ever get on a space craft. And that means that even if you're not in situ, you can still do some really impressive stuff. There's some designs of spectrometer that allow you to measure the winds in the upper atmosphere, for instance, which is something that I was talking about briefly at the start when I talked about trying to understand the flows and the chemistry in the upper atmosphere. So that's something that I actually do as a ground-based observer that you basically would find it incredibly difficult to do from space. So there's room for both observations from the ground and space when you're doing these observations. But hopefully what you'll see in the next couple of slides is how difficult these observations are. Okay, so if we go to the next slide, what you should see is a rather cramped-looking office. That's the kind of place you observe from when you go up the mountain. It's at 14,000 foot high, so you've only got 60% of the oxygen you normally have, so your brain doesn't work particularly well. Another problem with observing Saturn particularly, you can see in the bottom right-hand side, there's a fuzzy picture of Saturn. That normally, when you observe an object, you guide on that object using a specialized guider, but these guiders just can't deal with Saturn with its rings. So you can never guide on the object itself. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you can use an off-axis object, but generally speaking, it ends up with us staring at a computer screen for 6 hours or 12 hours a night, desperately trying to keep the planet in the right place. So if the movie in the bottom left is working, you'll see Henrik, my postdoc, and I working, and Henrik is often covering one eye and staring at the computer screen, trying to see where Saturn is and trying to keep it on the straight and narrow. So this is difficult observing conditions. It's tiring. There's human error coming into the problems. No matter how good an environment Mauna Kea is, it's still not perfect. So you're going to see some smearing out of the object because of seeing, some loss of transmission, and all of those problems I talked about. So all of that leads up to the next slide, which is the first ever image of the infrared aurora of Saturn from the Earth, which I took a couple of years ago. And what you can see is we have something of a fuzzy blob at the bottom of the planet. You can see, you can sort of see the rings and then a sort of roundish fuzzy blob. You can make out some major morphological structures, and when we look at different images and compare them with the UV, we can see similar structures, but they're very much smeared out compared to what you see from the UV. It's very difficult to see the details of what's going on. What we can also do is look at that region as a whole, add up a spectra taken across the whole region for a period of 6 hours or more, crunch it all together across the whole region to produce a single temperature measurement. So this is the first time anyone's measured the temperature for Saturn. This was an observation done by Steve Miller, a colleague of mine, a couple of years ago, and it came out with a temperature for the entire rural region of 400 Kelvin. I think it's worth bearing this image and this temperature measurement in mind when we move on, as we are about to looking at the observations we've done from BIMS, because it really, I think, puts into contrast the absolute importance of the work that Cassini is doing. So if we move to the next slide, you'll see a set of 9 images, and absolutely fantastic images they are too, from the VIMS instrument. And what you can see is all sorts of dynamic structure. Now, I'm not going to talk in too much detail about this kind of structure, because I know Wayne has all sorts of fantastic images and movies to show you, which perhaps explains what's going on here better than these images could. But there are some basic structures here that are very similar to what you will see in Wayne's talk. You can see a main auroral oval that's very clean, so at a sort of collatitude of 15, so that's 75 degrees. In some of them, particularly the top left one, and maybe cresting around the edge of the planet on the top right and bottom left, is a secondary oval that seems to happen only on the midnight side of the planet. That happens at lower latitudes and doesn't seem to extend all the way around the planet. There's also an indication of a kind of structure that Wayne may talk about called a Q-aurora. Wayne has a wonderful set of animations of the Q-aurora as it moves around the planet. The middle left panel shows an interesting sort of feature at the top. Now, this is twisted 45 degrees. But this image that we have from VIMS comes immediately after a sequence taken by the UV's instrument. So we know that this is Q-aurora because we see it happen in the UV, and this is the final step taken immediately after the infrared. So we have all sorts of information here, and we're able to use it to compare and contrast with the UV. And obviously, as we've been discussing already, the extended mission will hopefully go back and be able to allow us to do this comparison in a much more level of detail, that there's at least some ways we can compare and contrast what we're seeing here with what we've seen in the UV. And generally speaking, the structure seems very similar, but one aspect of the aurora, at least here, that jumps out as being at least somewhat different is what's happening inside of the polar cap. You see some emissional features in the UV, but you don't see anything nearly as bright as anything you even see in these images. So if we go to the next slide, you'll see some extreme cases of bright polar aurora. The one on the right sees brightening on the dawn side, which is not necessarily that different to what you see in the UV, but the one on the left, and I've marked it out using these gray lines, really shows you the difference. And you can see where the edge of the planet is underneath that. And so the bottom two panels are basically a visual, are the visible wavelengths. So that's a red, green, blue image of Saturn. So you can sort of see its yellowish color. But mostly this is on the night side of the planet. And so this is on the northern hemisphere during winter. And what you can see is that the main auroral oval goes on the outside of the gray lines. And then we have this big clump of emission on the inside of that gray line. And between the two, there is an extended region of darker material, so not nearly as bright. And that's an auroral structure that not only do we not really understand in any way, it's also one that we've never seen before on any other planet. So this is auroral structures that we're just not able to explain at the moment, and we're still trying to work towards trying to get a better explanation of what's causing this structure to form. It's very difficult to explain, obviously, without having any previous examples that really match up with what we've seen here. So there's quite a lot going on in terms of just looking at the intensity structure. Some of it relates directly to what you see in the UV, and we can sort of collaborate with the UV in terms of just providing more images of general structure, and also compare with the UV in order to understand differences between the structure. But I'm going to go back to the temperatures now and talk a little bit more about what we can do there. So if we go to the next slide, you'll see a whole slew of images. And this is basically 256 images from VIMS. Whenever VIMS takes an image, it actually takes 256 images in the infrared and 92 in the visible light. So this is the whole of the this is a whole stack of images taken at the same time as each other in the infrared. And I've split it up on the right into different regions. And what you can see is that a lot of it is dominated by reflected sunlight. But as I said before, you see some regions where the absorption of sunlight by methane basically makes the planet dark, and you don't see that reflected sunlight anymore. And that region happens by lucky chance to fall at the same wavelength as you see the brightest of this infrared H3+ emission. And if you remember back to that spectra I showed from Jupiter, it should hopefully be somewhat reminiscent from this sort of pattern of observations we're seeing here. And you can see multiple little circles in that auroral emission region. So that's a multiple images of the emission from Saturn's auroral region, taken at the same time but at different wavelengths. And then finally at the top you see thermal emission. So this is a region of observations that I'm not personally interested in, but obviously is of great interest to lower atmosphere people. And this is a region where, if you remember back to that transmission spectra, basically there was a huge amount of absorption in the Earth's atmosphere. So this is this upper region at the top, those bright images, we just never see from the ground. So right there, there's an example of how VIMS is providing us with new information about the planet. But if we zoom in on some of these images in the middle with the aurora, on the next slide, you can see I've picked out a whole set of images, some of them with an obvious aurora in them, some of them with no aurora in them, and gradations between the two. And what you can see is that the general structure of those aurora, because they're taken at the same time, are very very similar. But what I've done is I've shown you what is producing each of those images. So the bottom left shows you four or five straight lines underneath a Gaussian. And the Gaussian is the window that the VIMS instrument at that particular bin looks through. And basically the auroral image that you're seeing is produced by a whole set of different lines, those lines we saw in the spectra for Jupiter earlier. And then on the right-hand side, you've got another image, and that's produced by two lines at different wavelengths. And the important point here is that when you look at those separate lines, the brightness of each individual line varies relative to each other depending on temperature. So as it gets hotter, different lines start getting brighter faster compared with other lines. And basically what that means is we can work back from that and compare the intensity of each of the lines, of each of the bins, of each of the images, to produce a temperature. So if we go to the second to last slide, what you'll see is I've produced a whole set of images here. And some of them have quite a strong reflected sunlight component in them. But we're only going to look at a single pixel. So this is just one pixel within each of those images. And it's the same pixel within each of those images. And what we're doing is that we're looking at the relative brightnesses of the aurora in each of those images relative to each other. And underneath that is a line plot showing that brightness. Now, what I've done is I've produced two modeled values. So I've shown what the relative brightness of each of the bins should be in an ideal world at 300 and 600 degrees Kelvin, 300 for the dot line and 600 for the dash line. So if we had a perfect model of the brightness from the aurora, it should fall with a pattern somewhere between that. But of course, there's some noise involved here, so it doesn't quite fit. So the straight line is our actual data. But what you can see is that while it doesn't fit perfectly, it does fit surprisingly well between these two values. And what you see is you can, on a pixel-by-pixel basis, pick out a temperature based on the relative intensity of each of the different bins that we're looking at. So if we go to the final slide here, this is, I have to say, very preliminary work, and in fact is a little bit out of date now, but what it shows you is the principle involved. And what we've done is, on the left-hand side, you have five separate images, and this is a really interesting set of observations that we've made with VIMS, where we took data over a period of about 12 hours. So there's five separate images from that 12-hour period. The top two and the bottom two are very close to each other. So there's only a 45-minute period difference between those two images. Then there's a four-hour jump, and then another four-hour jump, and then the next two, the final two, are again separated by 45 minutes. So it's showing us the variability in the infrared aurora over a relatively short time scale, not nearly as short as some of the observations we have with the UV that Wayne will show, but still on a surprisingly short time scale compared to the strength and magnificence of Jupiter, certainly. And what have we done for this is we've measured on a pixel-by-pixel basis and fitted what we think the best temperature fit is across this region. And you can see the second panel shows those temperatures up. And it's very interesting. What seems to be showing up is that the regions where you have heating caused by the aurora, you get hotter temperatures, which is something that maybe wouldn't surprise you particularly. I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done in this. But the third panel is just a difference plot between each of these temperature maps. And what it shows is that there are regions of heating and cooling within the atmosphere, and that heating and cooling is very dynamic. So this, while this result, it, as I show it here, isn't necessarily the correct result, what it's showing us is that when we get down to getting that calibration perfectly right for the temperatures, we should see a great variation in the temperature structure over surprisingly short periods of time. And that suggests back to when one of the first things I talked about, trying to understand the temperature structure in the upper atmosphere and why it's so hot. A lot of the models that are used at the moment are very static models. So one idea is potentially that because they're quite static models, they're just not taking account of this vast variation. So hopefully with more detailed observations, and of course we've seen some of those wonderfully pretty images much more that have a lot more detail of the auroral structure than the ones that I've shown here, those will also have much more detailed temperature maps associated with them. So hopefully not only will we be able to get a better understanding of the auroral the magnetosphere ionosphere coupling, but also the ionosphere thermosphere coupling and how that affects the planet's upper atmosphere as a whole. So I think that's a good place to leave it.
That was great, Tom. Thank you very much. I think you're headed back to Hawaii for more observing. Is that correct?
I am actually headed back to Hawaii in about a week.
And are you going to be looking at Saturn?
I certainly am. And, in fact, it's quite exciting. By complete chance, we're going to be looking at the aurora, much like I've shown here. And then at the same time, my colleague Steve Miller will be looking for H3O+ in the upper atmosphere, which is the first time anyone's ever done that. But he'll be observing not only at the same time on the same mountain, but in the same location on the same planet. So that would be fantastic.
Wow, that's cool. You'll have to let us know how that turns out.
Yeah, absolutely.
It sounds like the observing conditions are kind of brutal. So for those of us that don't do that kind of thing, you basically have to keep the image centered in a particular location visually, or?
It can get to that, yeah. I mean, normally when you do an observation of, say, a galaxy or a star, everything is very simple, relatively speaking, because you're looking at the background sky. So you know how fast it moves. It moves at the rotation rate of the planet. It's relatively easy to keep it on center. And usually all you need to do is fit it with a Gaussian, and that Gaussian will tell you the center of that object. And you can use that to guide on the planet or on the object very easily. So that's something we do when we look at Uranus, for instance. But because you're fitting a Gaussian, you just can't fit a Gaussian to Saturn because it's got that odd shape. And that makes it much, much harder to do, basically.
Yeah. Oh.
So, hours of concentration, basically.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Tom out there? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Thomas. Really good.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Uliana Dudina. And so for those of us listening in real time, please download her presentation. It's Dudina 1, the PowerPoint. And with that, I'll introduce Uliana Dudina. Again, she's a staff scientist at Caltech, and she works with the imaging team. So, Uliana?
Thank you. Hi. I will present Cassini images and movies of Aurora. So be sure to download the movie, one movie, that were captured in visible light. The background image on the first slide is not from Saturn, it's from Earth, and it shows the colors of the terrestrial aurora. For the Saturn data, they are not in color just yet. We're hoping for the future observations for that. And only Cassini spacecraft has the capability to see aurora in visible light, because we have to be on the night side, so it has to be the spacecraft. And even with Cassini camera, the aurora is pretty faint. It's a tricky observation. But yeah, we had imaged aurora finally, and have quite spectacular aurora movie in broadband visible light. It's not only that it's the first observation in visible light, but it's a very high resolution. It's 32 kilometers per pixel, so we can see a lot of geometric structure to those aurora curtains. Second slide shows the geometry of our observations. Just to make collaborative observations a little bit more complicated, this was not taken from the polar expedition kind of observations. That was merely from the ring plane. And on the left image, the day side crescent is on the left, and the night side on the right. So we're looking at the night side at the north and latitudes, and the red box shows the frame. The inset shows the actual image from that place. We have taken lots of that image to put them in the movie. Images, and we can see the white stars at the background. We can see a little piece of the day side from the day side crescent, and what's shown is in orange is the aurora that changes with time. There are nearly 500 frames taken within 81 hours on October 5th to October 8th, 2009. Each has 2 or 3 minute exposure, so that's pretty high frequency movie. There are some gaps in the movie, so it's not completely, the 81 hour is not covered completely by the movie, but has gaps. So the orange color was pretty much painted on the actual observation, so we can the spectator can be, you can see the aurora, distinguish aurora from other things that are going on in the movie. And in reality, there's no color information in those movies. It's just a broadband covering the whole spectrum of the visible light because we wanted to catch as many photons as we could in those faint lightning, faint aurora. Slide number 3 shows the actual movie. If you click, it's hopefully going to start. the movie is looped to play several times, and the end of the one movie fades away, and then it starts again from the beginning, so it's pretty clear where it so what we can see are the white stars that are going by in the background because the spacecraft is moving during that 81 hours of the observation. The orange painted aurora oval changes and moves from the left to right together with the Saturn when Saturn rotates as we view it. It's about latitude 75 degrees as in infrared and in UV observations, and it goes north and south with time.
Well, Liana,
can
I interrupt you? For me, the movie didn't play in the PowerPoint. I'm not sure why, but you can download the movie. That's okay. Maybe for other people it did, but if it doesn't play for you, it's the movie that starts PIA 11681, and you can download it and just play it in QuickTime or whatever you have available. Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Liana. Thank you.
Okay. Did you get this?
Did I get what?
The movie playing.
Yeah, I have it playing, but for those out there who couldn't get it to play within the PowerPoint, you can play it separately.
Okay.
Please continue.
So the aurora, the orange aurora, moves left to right, and then it turns around the corner where this latitude of 75 degrees moves away from us behind the horizon. We can see two separate time scales of the aurora in this movie. The curtains are pretty faint structures, and they're pretty much frozen to the Saturn rotation. And more than that, if we're looking at the next day, they reappear at similar places 10 hours later. So that's one time scale, and they are pretty stable. The other time scale is the sudden brightening of the aurora, and you can see that as the two snake-like structures on the oval that suddenly brighten at the end of the movie. So the first one is right across the disk, and the other brightening is the same thing, but it brightens as it turns around the corner. So that's really interesting, and this is really fast. So if you go to the next slide 4, you can see a still image of this snake-like structure, oral structure, and it appears within one frame, which means 3 minutes. And it fades away in a few frames, which is about 10 minutes time scale. We only see it twice, so these phenomena are pretty rare compared to just normal curtains. So the curtains are stable, and they keep their shape in the consecutive Saturn days. The next slide shows the curtain structure at our high resolution of 32 kilometers per pixel. We can measure the height of the curtain, and it goes more than 1,000 kilometers above the planet limb, which is more than anywhere in the solar system. Also, the curtain is separated from the surface, as it usually is on the Earth. Um, The location of the aurora in latitude is around 74 degrees, and as you saw in the movie, it moves up and down by a few degrees latitude. Slide 6 discusses an open question of the aurora real color. Earlier in 2006, there was another Cassini observation of aurora, not nearly as bright as in this movie, but it was in different filters that probed different colors. From that 2006 data, we can say, we can tell that there are hydrogen emission, H-alpha emission, line in the aurora. So it is possible that Saturnian aurora has multiple colors as the Earth does. And on Earth, as you can see in the background image, aurora can have different colors, and different parts of the aurora have different colors. So we're all excited about taking that future images and hoping to get the color information. On Earth, the glowing gases are oxygen, nitrogen, and other, and they create green, red, and other multiple colors in the aurora display. On Saturn, the gas that is supposed to glow is hydrogen, and probably others. So this would be really interesting to see if we manage to catch the aurora in the future observations. The last slide talks about the observations, and there have been many attempts to detect auroras so far by Cassini camera, but there were not that many successes. So there was just a few very noisy images up until this fall, in this movie, in this fall. Learned from trial and error, we will continue the observations and the geometry that this movie had been taken, and this proved to be successful. So we're going to repeat that. We will attempt to capture color. We will try more frequent frame rate at the expense of spatial resolution, which hopefully is going to work, and we're going to have more information about the fine timing of the aurora. Also, we would need luck, because this aurora in this movie was much brighter than anything that had been recorded so far, so we're probably just looking at the bright aurora happening on Saturn this time. So we hope that we're going to get more detections. We now know better how to observe aurora invisible, and we're hoping on the extended mission to get more information about aurora and the magnetosphere of Saturn. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Ileana. So what did you learn about the observations? I mean, how did you change things as time went on? Did you just make them longer in duration, or what?
Well, basically, instead of first thing that proved to be very efficient is looking at the aurora at the side, edge on, instead of looking from the top to those aurora curtains, we see much more when we're looking at the limb and the aurora is above. The other thing that really worked was degrading the spatial resolution, and then we can make exposures much shorter. So we see the motion. So movies work much better than the still images with long exposures.
Uh-huh, okay. So when you get the, you want to get the color in the extended mission, how long does that extend your, increase your observation time? Is that, or your exposure time?
We've never tried really low resolution for the dark images. There's a trade-off between the duration of exposure and the spatial resolution. So we can collect much more light if we make pixels larger.
Right.
So this is the way I'm going to approach this problem. And for the color, the exposures have to be really long to detect reasonably low level of light.
Mm-hmm.
If we degrade the resolution, we can make shorter exposures, and that's the thing that is hopefully going to work for the color.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. Are there any other questions for Liliana? Okay, well, thank you very much. It was very interesting. Great movie. So our final speaker is Wayne Pryor, and so that presentation is on the website, and that's Pryor, P-R-Y-O-R. And Wayne is a UVIS co-I, and he's been looking at the aurora in the UV, and I'll just let him start. So are you there, Wayne?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, first comment is this one is movie intensive.
Yep.
So to get the most out of this, there are a number of movies next to the PowerPoint, and you'd need to download those to get the maximum out of this talk.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm on the first slide. That's just the intro. UVIS stands for Ultraviolet Imaging Spectrograph. Go to the second slide. The way we make images with UVIS is we let the light in through a long slit, shown in this picture of a slit painted on Saturn. And then along that slit, you get 64 channels of spatial information along with a full spectrum of spectral information. And then when you can get permission to move the whole spacecraft around, you can slew that slit back and forth and make images. The kinds of emissions we're looking at in the ultraviolet for the auroras are emissions from molecular hydrogen and atomic hydrogen that have been excited by electrons striking them, those currents that Dean was talking about. So go to the next one. This shows an example of the kinds of images we can get with UVIS when the spacecraft is slewed back and forth. The lower left panel shows actual data from UVIS when the spacecraft was slowly slewed back and forth across the planet. And you can see Saturn's rings. You can see the ring shadows on the planet. And if you look in the blue, you'll see auroras showing up actually at both ends of the planet. So this is color-coded, where the blue is electron-excited, molecular and atomic hydrogen. UV emissions in the aurora are actually a lot brighter than the visible ones that Liliana was just talking about. So we see the aurora pretty much all the time in the UV, and it's enough brighter that you can even see them on the day side. The camera, the ISS, has the advantage of very good spatial resolution. Okay, now if you look at the bottom of those two pictures there, you'll see complete ovals and a feature that cuts across the middle of the oval, a polar emission like Tom was talking about. We see that fairly often in the UVIS data. I may call that transpolar arcs a few times. Let's go to the next one. A subject of some interest is the one moon of Saturn, Enceladus, which has been exciting everybody because it has geysers. And water vapor and water ice particles are being thrown off the planet. And that's creating a cloud around the moon, which is then perturbing the magnetosphere, and it may set up effects on the field line near Enceladus, and so we were looking to see if there was any effect. In the case of Jupiter, several of the moons of Jupiter created effects on the field line near those moons, which led to spots of light on the planet Jupiter. So we were looking here to see if there was a spot on Saturn due to Enceladus. Previously, people had looked in Hubble data without success. But then in 2009, Abby Reimer presented evidence from CAPS and INCA data that there actually are beams of particles moving up and down the field lines near Enceladus, which might show up as a spot on Saturn. So we were looking around to see that we could see those in the UVIS data. We made use of magnetic field models provided by Stan Cowley, and we put little boxes on a bunch of our UVIS images to see if we could spot a footprint in any of those. So if you go to the next slide, you should see a big foot. That is a cartoon meant to give you an idea of what we're talking about. There are magnetic field lines around Saturn, which converge somewhat at the planet. You see those three arrows kind of converging towards the foot. Electrons spiral down those field lines, and some of those electrons may strike the atmosphere and create a glowing spot, like a fluorescent light bulb. The region on Enceladus, the size of Enceladus, would converge to a smaller spot on Saturn if there's something present there. So let's go to the next one. If you succeeded in downloading the movie, you will see a three-frame movie going on right now. This is a series of three images obtained in 2008 on one day. We've put a white box around where we expect to see any interaction with Enceladus showing up on Saturn. And if you look in those boxes, you'll see there is a spot present in all three. The brightnesses are indicated. The third one's actually a lot dimmer. We had to stretch the image quite a bit to make it show up in the third one. We consider this series of images pretty convincing evidence that there is at least occasionally a feature on Saturn due to the interaction with the moon Enceladus. If you look at the rest of the image, you'll see the main auroral oval is shown with quite a bit of structure. And I have to say, the auroral oval never seems to look the same twice. So there's a lot going on there, a lot of things to try to explain in the future. Let's go to the next slide. This is a cut through of the number of counts showing up in those images where the spot showed up. The first spot is featured in the top panel. The second spot featured in the bottom panel. I made a vertical line there to indicate where the effect of Enceladus is likely to show up. And you can see that in the top panel, there is an enhanced count rate near that vertical line, and somewhat off to the right as well, towards what we call the wake of Enceladus. In the bottom panel, the emission is pretty much centered on the location of Enceladus. So there's a hint there that the interaction may be over, at least sometimes over, a larger region than just Enceladus itself. Interaction with some kind of extended cloud of water products around Enceladus. If you go to the next slide, it shows we actually have spectral information about that spot. And most of the emission that's important here is around 1,200 in these figures. That's emission from hydrogen Lyman alpha. And there is emission there from hydrogen Lyman alpha. There's also emission at the spot from H2 band emission showing up, especially near 1,600 angstroms. The spectrum is not unusual. The spectrum looks like the spectrum of other auroral events we've looked at. And generally speaking, the aurora on Saturn is due to fairly low energy particles, which strike the atmosphere and don't get very far into the atmosphere. This is what Eliana was talking about a minute ago. She said the Saturn aurora is very high, and that's true compared to Jupiter. The particle energies seem to be lower, and the auroral spectra seem to indicate this as well. The way it indicates that is by the ratio of the different wavelength ranges. If there is very penetrating auroras, the short wavelength end is attenuated, reduced, due to the presence of methane. And that's not showing up here. These are probably fairly shallow auroras, not going very deep into the atmosphere. If you go to the next slide, this summarizes our search for the Enceladus foot. I showed three images that have the spot. There are at least two others that I believe show the spot. There may be a few other cases. This is out of several hundred images, so usually we can't actually see the spot. It's fairly faint compared to the main auroral oval on the planet. And it may be intermittent. There may be days when it's brighter than other days. And I should point out those three spots we did find were on the day side. And we can find things even on the day side because the UV emissions are rather bright and because with a spectrometer we can filter out the reflected sunlight component and leaving just the spot you want to look at. Okay, moving on to the next slide. It says UVIS movies on the top. I'll be showing several of the UVIS movies we've taken. There are a couple dozen movies we have taken so far. I didn't want you to download quite that many movies, but I selected a few that you can look at that hopefully will highlight a few of the features that are most interesting. Most of our observations are of the North Pole, a few of the South Pole, mostly of the North Pole. If you go to the next slide, this shows the first good movie we got. This was back in 2007. And I show in red and then in blue the rotating planet. And then finally the blue with the geometry grid laid on it. You can see the main oval more or less follows the latitude lines. The point of that red one with the clock hand, if you hit it, it should run again, is to show that at least on this particular day, the features in the aurora were more or less moving at the rotation rate of Saturn. So this would be a more or less co-rotational case. In terms of Dean's different cases, some were sub-co-rotational, some were super-co-rotational. Another thing to point out in this one is on the side, on the red movie, if you run it again and again, you see sunlight to the left. And then on the right side, towards midnight, you will see the oval is typically doubled. This has been showing up in Hubble images as well. There seems to be an extra auroral oval on the backside, on the night side, in many cases. Okay, the next one is called 2008-002. It's a looping movie. And I've below the looping movie, I picked out the favorite frame from that movie, which shows a series of polar spots which appear in a single frame. Some kind of event where electrons are striking the atmosphere at several different locations at the same time inside the main oval.
Are we on slide 12, Wayne?
Let's see.
Or are we on 11?
It says 2008-002 on the top.
So that's slide 12. Thanks.
12. Okay. Yeah, I don't have slide numbers on the presentation. Okay, this next one is called 2008, day 129. Claudia already described this particular event, although here's the movie for it. Don Mitchell assembled the combined movie on the left, which shows a blob rotating around Saturn. And that blob we call the ring current, and notice it's localized at one longitude. Don describes these as injections that happen on the midnight to dawn part, and they rotate around. And if you hit that movie again, it will run again. You can see how that moves around. And as that blob, that very bright red blob, moves around, the auroras also brighten. And the auroras are shown as the blue inner ring there. So that's UVIS data right in the middle, and then MIMI INCA data in the larger frame. Then on the right side, you can see the original UVIS movies that went into the inset in the left side. You can see how the structure really changes. The main oval seems to add a loop on its outside and brighten as that ring current blob rotates around. There seems to be a correlation. Don Mitchell's already published a paper on this you could go look at if you want to. Okay, if you go to the next one, 2008, day 197, it says. This is actually a southern one. And I really like that little movie clip. If you hit it a few times, you'll see the thing go through.
Hello.
Sorry
about
that.
There is a very strange look to the southern aurora in this one. One gets the sense of small eddies going around the oval in a sort of a periodic way. Material that seems to cross from one latitude to another in sort of a diagonal or spiral fashion. And there seems to be some sort of vorticity in the individual spots there. Things are rotating as they rotate around. So very complicated features. I'd love to have someone explain that one to me sometime. Next one is called 2008, day 201, Lair in the North. This is a rather long movie. Again, you can always restart it by hitting it again. You will see features rotating around. You'll see a single frame, which is much brighter than the others, in a small spot. And I've highlighted that to the left in the still frames. You'll see the word flare and an arrow pointing to the flare. This flare feature is actually inside the oval. Now, if you hit this movie again, perhaps the most interesting thing besides the flare in the movie is that towards the end, a number of linear features form and extend at right angles to the main oval. Geometry is not clear from the movie, but that's actually towards the noon side. That those linear features grow that seem to cross the latitude lines across the main oval, coming out of what we might call the cusp region. It ends in a shape we call a Q. Turns out this sort of Q shape has shown up in a number of our movies. We're calling this the Q aurora. And it represents some kind of motion across what we call traditional L shells. Whether the some kind of disturbance is crossing the latitudes, let's put it that way. The next movie is called 2008, day 208. And again, the stills on the left will show you a flare, a particular point that brightened considerably in one single frame. This particular clip also shows what we're calling a transpolar arc. It's a feature inside the oval which persists over hours. Similar sorts of things are seen on the Earth, sometimes called theta auroras. But again, this one has a lot of activity inside the polar cap, as Tom saw in some of his infrared images. The next slide is a cut across the images that had the flares, the day 201 flare and the day 208 flare. So you get some idea of what I'm talking about. The main auroral ovals are showing up near count level 200 in these images, in these frames. Then you'll see a spike in each one near the center. Those spikes are what I'm calling flares, where a small spot inside the polar cap or near the cusp brightens by a factor of several over the normal auroral oval. There's something different about those. For Saturn, these have not previously been reported. In the case of Jupiter, flares seem to occur inside the polar cap fairly often. Perhaps a signature of some kind of reconnection event, they say, out near the magnetopause. So if you go to the next slide, it says 2008 UVIS flare spectra. So again, we've got both cases, the day 201 flare in the top panel, the day 208 flare in the bottom panel. The green spectra are typical aurora spectra. A lot of emission near 1216, which is Lyman Alpha, and some emission out near 1600, that's H2 band emission. Then the flare spectra are marked in the dark, thick color. And notice that at the long wavelength, if I've normalized them near 1600, made them match in count rate near 1600, then you look over here to the short end, there aren't nearly as many counts at the short wavelength end in these two cases. And this is consistent with electrons that have more energy, so they're able to penetrate a larger column of methane, which absorbs strongly below about 1,400 angstroms. This is a clue that these flares, these two flare events, are not only bright, but they're also penetrating electrons, unusually high energy. The next slide says 2009, day 23, has a little looping movie, which is five frames. This is a very high-quality movie, I think, so it's worth spending a little time just staring at it. You'll see a pretty well-defined limb in the upper left of the movie, the edge of Saturn. And above that, you'll see some arc-like features. I think those are the rings showing up in the background. Then if you look at the aurora itself, you'll see that there are multiple arcs, perhaps three distinct ovals are showing up. There's one feature that blinks in a single frame. It's a bright spot. I haven't looked at that spectrum yet. I'll bet it's another flare-like feature. But the main thing to call attention to in this movie is the jet of material that seems to start near the oval or just inside the oval and then jets out to the left. Again, this creates a Q shape. This seems to be a common feature in our movies, is material from the cusp region spreading out into a linear feature at right angles to the main oval, forming what we call a Q aurora. Okay, and then finally, the conclusions. Just reminding you of what I said, that UVIS has detected signature of an Enceladus auroral footprint, a small spot on the same field line as the moon Enceladus, or in that region. We've seen a lot of movies and images. We have about 500 images so far. We hope to get more in the future. Interesting features, we mentioned transpolar arcs. Those were arcs that cut across the inside of the oval and seemed to persist for hours. These have been seen at the Earth. Reported on auroral flares, transient events inside the polar cap, which seem to be bright and involve energetic electrons. And we reported finally on the most mysterious thing perhaps in this data, which are the Q auroras, arcs that form near noon and spread in one or two directions. They can either go towards the pole and away from the pole, or just one way or the other. They lengthen, and in some cases they split in the middle and separate. And we're calling these new features the Q aurora, maybe the neatest thing we've found. So as I said, we're hoping to get more observations. I guess the mission goes to 2017, so there should be more opportunities if we're lucky and everything stays healthy. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne. That was great. It looks like with those Q auroras, you're talking about the vorticity. It looks like kind of near the tail of the Q, there's more vorticity. Is that how it appears to you, or is it just...
Are you looking at the one on day 23? Or?
I'll have to go back here.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure.
Day 23 was the one before the last.
Yeah. That's the one.
Okay, so that's not what I was describing as the vorticity, although there might be something like that in there.
It seemed like when the material jets out, the vorticity is higher, kind of near the tail of the queue. But I don't know.
Okay.
That was just my first impression.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I know in the XXM we've been planning observations of the auroral Enceladus footprint in one of the upcoming sequences. So hopefully that will pan out. But like you say, it's bound to be very episodic if it's related to Enceladus activity. And so I guess it'll be a hard thing to capture images of pre-planning it. You know, it'll just be kind of serendipity if we get images of the footprint again, don't you think?
Yes, we may need more than one attempt to catch it again, that's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah. Well, that was very good. Any questions for Wayne or any of the other speakers or any final comments from anybody? Claudia, do you have anything else to say about...
No, I thought this was actually fascinating. That I was glad, just from a scientific standpoint, to have the opportunity to go through this with everyone. So I want to thank all the speakers again. I think, you know, if we were to talk a little bit more about this, I would, you know, it's almost like a forest in the trees. You know, we spent some time here kind of going through the trees. And, you know, but the big picture is also fascinating, you know, of how all this contributes to, speeding up or slowing down potentially the, you know, pumping the atmosphere or pumping the magnetosphere and, the various chemical, I was listening to the energy input discussions and even Wayne talking about this, the Q aurora, the flares jetting out. And so, you know, hopefully maybe next time we can talk a little bit more about some of the big picture issues, the overall coupling and stuff like that, which is cool stuff.
Yeah. Okay, well, with that, I think this has been really fascinating. It's really good to hear it on a kind of a broader level than sometimes, you know, we go and hear scientific talks and they tend to be very focused. So it's really nice to kind of take a step back and see, some higher level. So with that, I think I'll call the Charm Telecondo close and thank all five speakers. And I know it's a lot of work to put these presentations together, but thank you very much. And we'll talk to everyone at next month's Charm Telecon. Bye-bye.